So the class has felt a little scattered in this first month. I'm sorry for that, with the break last week and then the kind of swapping it out we did before that. Hopefully we're going to get right back on track here. I still have kind of two big picture things that I wanted to talk about. And so I've blended those into one class tonight. And then next week, it's back to the Beatitudes and salt and light and on from there. So two things I want us to think about tonight. I want us to think about the Sermon on the Mount in the bigger Bible story. And I want us to think about preaching. And we'll see if time allows us to say a little bit about both of those. So let me start with something we have emphasized in the class over and over again, and that is not to let ourselves be ruled in how we view Scripture by chapter and verse divisions, right? We've emphasized that enough. Those are man-made and inserted and sometimes helpful and sometimes not helpful. And we've already illustrated with the Sermon on the Mount that actually there are some themes that work their way through the sermon that Matthew was working on before he got to the sermon. Can you remember any of those? I mean, it has been like 2 weeks ago since we talked about that.
Crowds.
What about the crowds?
They're following him, and this is intended for a big group of different people of different... They bring a bunch of different things to the table.
Yeah, so there were some pieces about different crowds along the way. Thank you, John. Anything else that he was working on before we got to this? The sermon? I really hope that you will remember the idea of his kingship. How far back does that go in Matthew? Yeah, how about like to the first verse of Matthew where he has the kingly lineage? And so the idea of Jesus being the king, and then in the sermon, the one teaching with authority, right? That's an idea that Matthew has been working on for a while. So the point we have made is when we're working a verse or a chapter, it's important to look a little bit before and a little bit after and pay attention to what the writer's been talking about, because there may be some things that tie together. We call that working the immediate context. Now, what I'd like to do tonight is blow that up bigger, because in addition to each writer sort of working a context, the Bible is telling a story, right? You with me on that? From Genesis to Revelation, even though it's 66 books separated by 1,500 years, you had all these people contributing to what winds up being one story. And so a second thing I would recommend is that when we're working a segment of the Bible, I think it's also helpful to pause and ask, well, how does this connect to, let's call it the remote context? How does this connect to the bigger Bible story? Does there exist some point that this piece contributes to that story? For example, some of this is easy sometimes. The crucifixion account that all four writers are going to describe in the Gospels. Does that connect to the rest of the story? Yeah. Please say, duh, you're asking us that question? I know, right? What is the crucifixion?
The culmination of all of it.
Yes. Yes, it's like when Jason Bourne kills the bad guy and it's all over, right? It's the climactic point of the whole story when Christ dies and rises again. And now, I probably shouldn't mention Jason Bourne on the live stream. That may not have been a good idea. There's a book?
It's not Matt Damon.
I'm learning all kinds of things tonight. So, anyway, how far back does the crucifixion that Matthew will get to at the end, how far back does that go in the Bible story?
Genesis 3.
Yeah. Yeah, all the way back to that part about Satan having someone come who's going to crush him, the seed of woman is going to crush him on the head, all of that was early hinting about the coming of Jesus. So you see the way that threads all the way through? The Bible is telling one story, and as we study the parts, I think it's helpful to ask, how does this part tie to the story? So, could we brainstorm that just for a little while tonight? I'm watching the clock. I want to get some other stuff, but I'm wondering, beyond what Matthew has been saying about kingdom and crowds and all that other kind of stuff, could the sermon have some connection to the bigger story? You have any thoughts about that? I do think that in a lot of ways, I hadn't thought about calling it a keynote speech, but it really is sort of serving that purpose. If you're in Matthew and look back at chapter 4, it's one of the reasons I would contend that actually the Sermon on the Mount should begin probably at verse 23 of chapter 4. Jesus was going throughout all of Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. I think that is what we're about to hear, the gospel of the kingdom. So that's what he was doing. Here's a sample of what it sounded like, sort of. I think we said that early on, this kind of a stump speech as he went from place to place preaching. What else? What other connections might the sermon have to the bigger story? Have thoughts about that? Okay.
That both is a precursor of how Jesus is going to serve us, as well as a outline for how we should then serve others.
So it foreshadows his service and the service to which he will call us that then works its way through the rest of what we learn about ourselves in the New Testament. Good. Thank you, John. Anybody else want to take a shot at that?
At the risk of sounding crazy, that is something about a test that the person has to die before the testimony has effect.
Say that again.
Is there not something out there about the testimony, like the person who makes the testimony has to die before the testimony has effect?
And there's something like that about wills in Hebrews. That may be what you're thinking about, but I'm not 100% on that. Yeah, about wills, right? Yeah, until he dies, it doesn't come to be of effect. So tell me where you're going with that.
So we're talking about the Sermon on the Mount, right?
Right. So the authority of the teacher, you're right, is underneath every bit of this. I think we made that point in 2 weeks ago in our class, that more important than what he said is the fact that the one who died and rose again said it. I think that's right. Yeah, Rick.
I think it just strikes me that this is God directly preaching to man, living the lesson. And it's very, very, it's like you've heard it said this, you've heard it said that. We got to up this. This isn't correct. I'm going to correct it, and I'm going to up it, and I'm going to help you think properly.
Yeah, now Rick's point is leaking down into my second point, okay? No, that's okay, because I think you're right. The Sermon on the Mount is God preaching to man, and so if you ever wanted to know what preaching is supposed to be like, how about just reading what God preached to man? So I'll say more about that in a minute. I will hold off on saying more. Let me give you one other thing to ponder. One of the things, I'll back up a second. There are different ways of looking at the Bible story. Let me offer one angle. One way of looking at it is that it is the story of God's search for a people. Do you buy that? The story of the Bible is God's search for a people that will be His. And so think how far back that goes. In Genesis 2, He puts Adam and Eve where? Garden. And he puts a tree there. One tree that he says, what? No, can't have this one. Have you ever wondered why the tree was there? If he hadn't put the tree there, they wouldn't have sinned, and then all this other mess wouldn't have followed. So God could have easily eliminated this problem by sticking them in the garden and leaving the tree out. That's an optimistic view of the story. Why is the tree there? Yeah, if there's no option to sin, there's no choice of God. And so in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve had to choose or not God, to choose to serve God. I think that gets more explicit with Israel. Let's go to the Old Testament for just a minute. I know, we're supposed to be in the Sermon on the Mount. We're going back to Exodus. But we will tie this together relatively quickly. Exodus 19. You remember when God brought Israel to Mount Sinai? And Moses goes up on the mountain. This is verse 3. And the Lord called out to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom, a priest, a holy nation. These are the words that you are to speak to the sons of Israel." So you see it there? I want you to choose to be my people. And was it a choice? To be his people, what would they have to do? Yeah, notice he said, "I'm just going to make you mine." He said, no, I'm giving you the choice to be mine. If you, verse 5, do what? Obey my voice and keep my covenant. And do you know what follows in chapter 20? The Ten Commandments that beginning of the law with that little preamble section, and then all the laws begin to follow. Does that feel familiar? It's kind of like the Sermon on the Mount, where we begin with the Beatitudes and what follows is the law. If Jeff were teaching the class, Jeff would say when they heard the Sermon on the Mount, they were supposed to think about the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. That's interesting. And then how did the people do with this covenant? Not so good. In fact, in the book of Hosea, God uses the prophet as an object lesson to say, you are not my, yeah, they've been unfaithful to him. He said, you are like an unfaithful spouse. God said, you cheated on me, right? And interesting, one of the children of Hosea is named Lo-Ami, meaning not my people. You see it? So that idea threads all the way through the Old Testament, that God is looking for this people who will be his. How about the New Testament? Yeah, so I actually went back and added 1 Peter 2. Hop over there. Because Caleb used it in his sermon last Sunday morning, and I thought, hey, this is perfect. I could use this in class. 1 Peter chapter 2. Let's just read a little bit of this. Start up in verse 1 of chapter 2. "Therefore, putting aside all malice and all deceit, and hypocrisy and envy and all slander, like newborn babes, long for the pure milk of the word, so that you may grow in respect to salvation if you've tasted the kindness of the Lord. And coming to him as to a living stone, which has been rejected by men, but is choice and precious in the sight of God, you also as living stones are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For this is contained in Scripture. Behold, I lay in Zion a choice stone, a precious stone, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed. This precious value then is for you who believe, but for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected became the very cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, for they stumbled because they are disobedient to the word, and to this doom they were also appointed. But you are, do you see it? A chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Listen to this, verse 10. For you were once not a people, but now you are the people of God. And you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. You hear it there? What is God looking for in the New Testament? People who will choose to be his. And notice, if we went back and just worked this text, that same idea there is the way we choose to be him is by his by doing what? Doing what he said. Being obedient. If we were just going to work this idea all night, I'd take you over to Ephesians 2 and talk about the Gentiles who were once not a people and now could be a people. So with that prelude, think back now about the sermon. Does the Sermon on the Mount have any connection to all of that? You could jump in any place you want to, man.
That's the last thing I'm going to say.
No, don't say that.
I'm going to quickly, if I found it, Hebrews 9:16-17, for where a testament is, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator. For a testament is enforced after men are dead, otherwise it is of no strength at all while the testator liveth. So I was just saying, he told us all these things, but to like,
well, and that's what happened. That's exactly right. That's the culmination of the story. Yeah, which then gives that authority to his message. It was the evidence that he was God. The message is to be believed. Man, is it getting hot in here or what?
I just turned it.
Did you? I need that apple on my phone. Okay, so back to the Sermon on the Mount. Do you see a connection between the Sermon on the Mount and this bigger Bible story of God trying to find people who will choose to be his? Yeah, and not just, you said it a minute ago, it's like his keynote speech, but his keynote speech about what?
What the kingdom is like.
Yeah, what does it mean to be my people? What does it mean to follow me? How much is that needed in the world today, where everybody kind of decides for themselves what it means to be a follower of Jesus? Listen, those are not his people. Because those who are his people choose him and choose his way and adhere to his covenant. And so I'm glad you actually said the keynote thing at the beginning, because that ties in well here. This is the keynote speech about who's in the kingdom, what it's like to be in the kingdom. Yeah. Oh, listen. I don't think it's possible for us to exaggerate how utterly bizarre this sermon was. They didn't read it like we do. We read it and think, oh, these are such beautiful sentiments. They heard the sermon and they're like, what? Who is this guy and what is he saying to us? It's just, the perspective is really, really, really different.
So much of it, he takes what they did know.
Yes.
And blows it into something that's so much more inward.
Right.
You know, not what people see.
Let me tell you how all the smart guys are getting this wrong. So that's what he does. All these guys, this Galilean carpenter is going to correct all the rabbis. That's coming to it. It's fascinating. Yeah, John.
It's kind of like your sermon this morning. It's always been the history of men and even God's people that they want to do what they want to do because that's what they like.
Yep.
As opposed to completely understanding what the will of God is and submitting to that will.
Yes.
And I think this Sermon on the Mount talks about principles of how to submit, how to get your mind in a position to where you can submit and do the will of God.
And so I hope we'll read the sermon that way. That this is part of this bigger story that's been told since Adam and Eve. God's looking for a people who will be His. This is what it's like. Or to put it in Old Covenant terms, this is the term of the covenant God is making with us at our Mount Sinai. And the question is, will we be His people, or lo ami, not my people? Yeah, Robert. Yes.
Pay attention.
Yes.
And he's the master teacher. And we know that. So it's just, we can read that over and over again. It's like if you're even a professional in something, sometimes it goes back to, if something's going awry, what do you do? You go back to basics.
Yeah.
Make sure you got the basics right. If you got the basics right, then you probably can correct the error.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of people who read the sermon as sort of this philosophy of life. So Jesus was another philosopher, and he comes along and he gives us his philosophy of life. And that is not what it is at all. What it is God, who from the beginning is looking for a people, saying, and these are the people that will be mine. If you're going to make that choice, this is your part of the covenant. This is what you need to do. And so I think we ought to read it in that bigger Bible story and think about the quest from the beginning to find people who will be His. Will we be His?
So then, can I add to that?
Please.
Many times we think that if I could have just been there and heard it in person, it would have really resonated with me. But you know, those folks, as you were saying earlier, they had a whole different perspective on how they were supposed to be ruled. Who is this guy? Who is he telling us this? Whereas from our perspective, we have all that God has laid out for us to know. And He paved the way for Jesus to become a man, to live and die for us.
Yeah.
And then to be taught by that man and be able to have those words was just, I think, we're much more beneficial than we are.
It really is helpful to try to read the Bible by getting inside the minds of the people who heard it. For example, you do appreciate that Genesis was written during the period of the Exodus, right? Have you ever read Genesis from that perspective? Go back and read Genesis and don't think about, oh, Moses is telling the story from the beginning. Go back and think, Moses is telling the story to the people who are on the Exodus. And it reads differently. And so when you read the Sermon on the Mount, yeah, I know we need to hear it for us, but hear it through their ears too. To these people who knew Jesus as a carpenter's son, not as the Son of God. And how utterly bizarre this is. And it only gets more bizarre the further you go through it, right? And more challenging for us. Okay, so I wanted you to think about the bigger story. The second thing I want you to think about, we're doing really good on time too, is the preaching that Jesus does here. Because we evaluate preaching, right? How awkward to have this conversation with one of the preachers teaching the class. But we do that, right? Do you have favorite preachers? Oh, come on, be honest, really? Come on, yes, of course you have favorite preachers, right? And you've judged preaching. Let's make this easy. Has anyone never gone away from a worship experience and said, that was a terrible sermon, right? Yeah, don't raise your hands. Come on, you've said that. If only in your mind, you've said it, right? So we've judged preaching, and you've said the other too. You've gone away and said to yourself, that was great preaching, right? And so how we judge that, I think, is interesting. How are we to judge it? I think it's important because it is in part through the teaching and preaching that we share in together that we learn what kind of people God wants to be His people. And so what makes it good or bad, I think, is kind of interesting. And studying the sermon, I think, gives us a really excellent opportunity to think about how we evaluate preaching. Maybe to challenge ourselves on how we evaluate preaching. Because in the Sermon on the Mount, who's preaching? I wanted y'all to say something else. Jesus is God. Yes, yes. So this is what God thinks is good preaching, which I think needs to be the standard for me and you too, right? So I want us to think about that a little bit tonight, and then I want that to sort of be a sub-processor that works through us all the way through the sermon. Pay attention to how Jesus operates as a preacher and a teacher, and let's make sure the standard He uses is our standard. So here's what I'm going to pitch to you. Hopefully you've had a chance to read through the sermon 3 or 4 or 5 times, all the way through from beginning to end. You've had a chance to kind of think about the preacher and how he chooses to teach. And so I'd like to make a list together tonight. What do you see about how he teaches? Is that an awkward question, or could you connect with me on that? How did Jesus teach? How did he preach? What words would you give to characterize it?
Vague.
I'm sorry?
Vague.
Vague. Tell me where you're going with that.
Many times he even says, I'm not going to give everybody everything they could possibly need to understand what I'm saying.
Okay, where do you see that? Where are you working when you think?
I have to go back and find it. He even tells his disciples, I'm telling you this stuff, but not everybody else is going to get the same message.
So I know, for example, with the parables, especially the parables, that sometimes the Lord is intentionally vague. To what end? Yeah, but you would think that he wanted everybody to understand. So why would he intentionally be vague? What does? Yeah, there it is, right there. That's right. I think that those who are genuinely curious are going to seek and want to know more. What about those who aren't? What? Yeah, they walk away. And so I do think that sometimes Jesus' teaching served as sort of a sifting purpose. He said things like in John 6, if you don't eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can't be part of my kingdom, right? There was a better way to say that, a gentler way to say that. Why did he say it like that? Well, because those who were just hanging on by the end of John 6 are leaving, right? And so I think, for example, the parables. Yeah. Sometimes with the parables, they're like, what does that mean? And so they come and ask. And that's why Jesus says, to you, it is granted to know. But to those who don't seek, it's not. Okay, so what else? Yep. I like the way you pounded your Bible. Do you think the Lord kind of pounded on the rock when he said that? I only hit the pulpit one time in 38 years, and I think an older woman nearly died when I did it, so I never did that again. Can I use another word along with that? It kind of ties into what we said 2 weeks ago. There is that air of authority about him that the crowds immediately picked up on. He does not teach like the rabbis teach, and it's part of what freaked them out. Yeah. I say to you, you've heard others say, but I say, yeah. We're going to dig into that in a couple of weeks. Yeah. Yeah, he was questioning them in the temple. That was also a kind of a bizarre incident. What else do you see about his teaching? Tell me where you're going, David. What do you see that you think is controversial?
Because he's telling them almost literally that he's saying that I didn't come to destroy the law, but they're going to know shortly that it's going to look, the kingdom is going to look vastly different than the old law. And my guess is they didn't, hardly anybody understood this. And so they had just seen him do all these miracles. That's why they were there in the first place. They had just crowded around him in earlier days because he healed so many of them. So they probably expected him to just blow the world up and start this magnificent march on Rome or something. And
right.
He didn't do that.
He didn't.
So here's all these miracles that nobody else can do. He's talking like God. He describes a kingdom that is vastly different from the old law.
Yeah, in fact,
the nature of people, not just what you have to do on Saturday.
Right. He also, it seems to me, particularly toward the end of 5, is wading into the middle of all these religious controversies, right? And so that when you said controversial, my mind went to all of this stuff here in chapter 5, for example, about divorce. Why does he talk about divorce in chapter 5, 31 and 32? Why does he go there? It was as controversial then as it was today. You had one school of rabbis who said, no, you can only get a divorce for adultery. And there are other people who come along, another school of rabbis who said, yeah, man, if you decide one morning you don't like the way she looks, you can go find a new one. Does that sound familiar? So Jesus wades right into the middle of these religious controversies. And the curious thing is, he doesn't say, you know, I'm really working with my disciples to get a good position on the divorce controversy. We'll get back with you on that. What does he do with these controversies?
Well, he tackles them head on. I mean, and it's not just the controversies, it's also the parties behind them. I mean, you know, he's saying you got to be better than the scribes and the Pharisees. He's saying to the zealots in the group, hey, if a Roman soldier says to go 1 mile, you better go 2 miles.
Yeah.
You think the zealots wanted to do that?
Oh, my. The section, so I'm going to teach this segment when I get back. And so I was doing some work on that last week. And I got to tell you, I think that little segment on retaliation may be the most difficult thing he says in this whole sermon. And he's going to smack us right between the eyes. I'm sorry, just get ready for that on the 24th. It's coming. It's a hard section of this. But the interesting thing is that when the Lord weighs in on the religious controversies of his day, first of all, he overrules the teachers. I know this is what you're hearing. This is what the truth is. And then the second thing he does is he gives definitive answers about that. So, yeah, vague was true sometimes, but sometimes he's not vague at all. Sometimes he says, you know, this controversy you're having, here is the truth about it, and it's coming from me. And so I think it blew people up for two reasons. One, man, he is dealing with a thorny piece of ground here. And then secondly, he's telling everybody, and I'm going to tell you what the rules are. And so that's why when he got done, everyone was like, who is this guy? Who does he think he is? He's teaching us like he has some right to say what the rules are. So, yeah, controversial to say the least, right?
And it gets to the heart of the matter, you know, about not just what people see you do, but what you think and feel. And it's not just about following the law. It's about being like him. I mean, he's not saying
that was the first thing I wrote in my notes. It was the first thing that came to my mind when I thought about Jesus as a teacher. And it's because I see this at the beginning in the Beatitudes, that he starts out by working the heart, right? Do you see him working the heart in the Beatitudes? How does he do it? What does he say? Things like,
pure in heart.
Yeah, there's an obvious one. Yes, you have to be pure in heart. But is that all?
Being meek.
You need to be gentle with people, which has that underlying sense of people's value and importance. And what else does he tell us? Yeah, be merciful. Be a peacemaker. How about blessed are those who are poor in spirit, who have a genuine inward sense of their spiritual poverty. And we go on and on and on with that. But it's interesting to me that the Lord addresses the heart and he does that on the front end. Why is that so important to do that? To work the heart and to work it first. Okay. Yeah, I think it assaults our temptation to turn our covenant with Christ into a checklist system of religion, where what God wants me to do is to get the list of boxes and go down and check off and get all the boxes right, right? And I don't think it's that way at all. I think we have it exactly backwards. I think that the gospel is designed to work on the inside first. Paul, when he called us to the new manhood, said, be renewed in the spirit of your mind. Get your heart right, and then that blossoms outward into the fruit of the Spirit, which is the figure that we use. I think if you try to do the fruit of the Spirit as a checklist, it doesn't work. Okay, so what do I need to demonstrate faithfulness today? What does that require of me? No. I think you first have a heart, right? That is humble, and the heart of a servant, and then that grows out and expresses itself as fruit in our life. Does that make sense? You see what I'm saying? And so I'm encouraged by what the Lord does here by starting where we need to start, and that is with where our hearts are, how we think, which will then in turn change the fruit. Rick, you've been very patient with me, and I appreciate that. Jump in.
I think it ties into your point, because I think of this as it's an invite to the broken. So it's very inclusive. You've got this giant crowd, so the preaching is inclusive, and it's to those that are broken. And you'll realize you're broken if you're humble enough and you're looking inward enough. And it reminds me of Luke 14, the invite to the feast. You wouldn't build a baseball team this way. You invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and those that are wandering around the road. It doesn't sound like, you know, why doesn't he just pick the winners? Because the winners are those who understand how much they need.
I think one of the interesting ways to read the Gospels is to pay attention to those places where Jesus tells us about who's in and who's out. And that's another one of those thematic ideas that I think we often miss. If I have this right, and don't hold me to this, but I think it's in Luke that the story of the rich young ruler is followed by what story pretty near after that? Anybody know? I'd say the short guy, but my wife might be insulted by that. Yes. It's followed by the little hobbit, right? The tax collecting hobbit in the New Testament, right? So why would the Holy Spirit lay the rich young ruler right up by Zacchaeus?
Zacchaeus was a rich young ruler. But who accepted it differently?
Everyone would have looked at the rich young ruler and said, oh, he's kingdom material. Who made the baseball illustration? Is that? Everyone would have looked at Rich Young Ruler and said, "Oh, I'm picking him first for my team. He is kingdom material." And had that work out? Yeah, no, not him. And then Zacchaeus comes along, and who would have picked him? I mean, he was a hobbit to start with. What's that? My wife likes Altuve because they see eye to eye. That's why he's her favorite player. So anyway, but nobody looked at Zacchaeus and thought he was in, right? He's a corrupt tax collector. Jesus said, I'm going to come stay at your house. And he has the penitent spirit there. So a great way to study the Gospels is pay attention to who's in and who's out, right? The house of the Pharisee and the disreputable woman that comes in to wash Jesus' feet. The Pharisee's out. The woman with a history, she's in. So it's all the way through the story. It's very, very fascinating. The gospel is inclusive, I like that, to the broken too. And Jesus collected those people. They were important to him. Thank you. What else do we learn about his preaching? Yep.
He spoke in a way that everybody in the audience could relate to it.
Okay. Relatable. How do you see that in the sermon? I wrote that message just in case I didn't spell it right. In the sermon, this ability to relate, or this effort to relate. Do you see it in the Sermon on the Mount?
When you said, you're the salt of the earth.
Yeah.
If you have lost your salt, how do you make it salty again?
Yeah. He used great figures, didn't he? Yeah. Common figures that we can all relate to. Yeah.
Building your house on the rock.
Yes. Gave us such good material for children's songs there at the end of the sermon. One, this little light of mine, too. I don't know if the Lord ever envisioned this little light of mine with Matthew 5:13, but nonetheless, beautiful figures. What else?
He was a saint.
Okay, now I'm not spelling that word. Okay? Two C's doesn't help me. I don't know what letter goes first. No. I got a better way of saying it.
First.
To the point. Where do you see that, David? What are you thinking of when you say that?
First verses, I get the impression that he just leaves these principles hanging in the air, and he moves on. How long does it take to say those few phrases? Probably moments. And they're probably by that time, some of them probably are, what is that?
I think there was a lot of that during the sermon. A lot of things. One of the things I wrote down in my notes is I think the sermon is challenging. Do you think that's right? Where do you see that? In what way is the sermon challenging?
It's convicting if you don't have those attributes.
It's convicting if you don't have the attributes. Yeah. How else is the sermon challenging?
What about anxiety?
Sorry? Yeah. It might be interesting to poll the room and find out what's challenging for you, because my mind goes first to love your enemies.
Murder means don't hate your brother.
Yeah, and even further than that, don't badmouth your brother. And yeah, I mean, you start that retaliation part, you start getting into that. And I think I thought more about that last week than I ever have before. And I thought,
yeah, that was perfectly justified on the old law. That is what came from God itself.
They took what was a legal standard and made it a justification for personal revenge. Now you have all you need to know about the retaliation session. But and not just don't retaliate, but what? Turn the other cheek.
Forgive.
Forgive. Be willing to take a loss.
70 times 7.
That's tough stuff. And then think about stuff like this. You've heard that it was said you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you what?
Lust.
Yeah. It isn't just about these outward actions that other people see. Listen, I don't want you messed up in your heart. Now he's working the heart again, right? Some of this stuff here is just really throwing down the gauntlet with us. I like what Jeff says. If you're going to follow Jesus, he's going to mess with your life. And then I wrote down the word right after that. In fact, I wrote down the word specific. Because in some of these places, he really gets down into the detail of our life. I don't want you looking at women and lusting after them, he says that. I want you to pray for your enemies and find ways to do good for them. I'm not saying there aren't any generic principles there. Love your enemies is pretty generic. I mean, you could apply that in a lot of directions, but sometimes his teaching is very, very specific.
David said he didn't belabor it. He said, here's what you think and here's what you should do.
And he just lays it out there.
On to the next one.
That's good. What else do you see about his teaching and preaching? So I put these two together, and let's play around with these a little bit. I put down that his message was positive and hopeful, and then right under that I wrote down his message was negative and condemning. Is that even conceivably possible to be both? I'm guessing John's going to talk to you all about this in a couple of weeks. Good luck with that, because I think that I do they even know what that means at that point? The Pharisees were considered the paragons of righteousness. I got to do better than them? I think it didn't even seem possible. And I like, at the end of the Beatitudes, what's promised to the persecuted? Yeah, the kingdom of heaven, right? And so it seems to me preaching ought to be that way sometimes, positive and hopeful. And then, as y'all have correctly pointed out, what does he say about lust? Yeah, and if you can't cut off your hand, pluck out your eye. Imagine being in that crowd. How bizarre was that, right? And not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will be the kingdom of heaven, but who? One who does the will of my Father. Many are going to say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, do we not prophesy in your name? And you may perform all these miracles. And I will say, I never knew you. Depart from me. You practice lawlessness. And so what's the takeaway from that? That he was positive and hopeful and negative and condemning.
That if you feel condemned, you better.
No. I think preaching is supposed to do both of those things. And I think our struggle is with balance, right? I remember working with a church. I was the new preacher at this church, and this guy came up to me and said, I got to tell you, it was just hard to come to church because last guy that was here, I just felt like I came in every week and got beat up. Can that happen? Can preaching become too negative and critical and tear us down? I think that can happen. Well, yes and no, because part of the reason I want to talk about this is preaching is not a little bit influenced by what you demand as an audience and as a church family, right? And so on the other side of that, some preaching is only positive today. I remember a friend of mine was church hopping, a guy I was studying with. He was trying to find a place to go to church. He visited this one place, and this guy leaned over and said, "You a guest?" And he said, "Yeah, first time." He said, "Oh, you'll love this place. No guilt here." So here's the point I would make about that, and that is the preaching ought to do both of those things, right? Sometimes it needs to be hopeful and encouraging, and frankly, if you don't go away at least occasionally with your toes a little sore and feeling guilty and challenged and indicted, someone isn't doing their job here. It ought to do both of those things. And I know, as preachers, we talk about that, but what's even more important is as a church, that's what you guys ought to demand of us and for the people who teach classes. It needs to do both of those things. So as we drive home and evaluate sermons, think about the Sermon on the Mount. Preaching ought to be like Jesus. Okay, so next week, Brian is going to be covering for me, and he's going to finish up the Beatitudes and then Salt and Light. So down to about verse 16 of chapter 5, and then John will grab that next segment on the connection between the sermon and the law. So that's where we'll be for the next couple of weeks.